So this session is supposed to be about environmental effects. And well, actually, I was asked to talk a little bit beyond environmental effects and you know, to all the topics that were addressed this afternoon. Or for me, it's an afternoon. For you, it may have been a morning or so. So let us first talk about the issue at hand, right? So if we have the pure isolated Kerr black hole, and we have what I would say, what I would call a nigh secondary, then we have something which I would call a vanilla embryo, right? So, you know, you have no extra ingredients that would make things a little bit more ambiguous or something like that. And I also call it vanilla because I would call it the basic model on which you can add on other effects such as environmental effects, right? And we have heard many talks this week where people just said, okay, this is extremely challenging as is. But this being said, let's go and talk about what else can happen in an emery, perhaps. And what are the other flavors than vanilla? So you can have beyond standard effects. For that, we already had a discussion in the week, so I'm not going to discuss them. But, you know, in principle, many of the mathematical things you need to do are very similar for both cases. You can have a nasty secondary. Really, so you can have a white dwarf, you can have a main sequence star. So I will touch on this as well, or I would like to touch on this as well. And then you can have environmental effects. You can have accretion disks, external matter perturbation, you know, these tidal perturbers. So you know, these are all in the mix. And let me now go very quickly through the questions that I kind of like gathered or brainstormed myself. Of course, we are open here to any questions that could come to. So, you know, one of them is, what are the correlations between environmental effects and formation? You know, so we had the talk of Jen Pan today about wet emeries and how they form. So is it correlated with an environmental effect such as hydrodynamical drag? How likely is it to find a third body to cause a resonance? Right, it was the talk of Priti Gupta, if I remember the name correctly. Sorry if I didn't say it correctly. And really, you know, door to door, you know, population times dynamics, right? So how likely is it really to see this in a waveform for Lisa, let's say? And a tangential question, how do we deal with resonances at all? Do we gather catalogs of resonances activated by various perturbations, or do we resign on this completely because it is too many parameters to keep track of in data analysis, and we just parameterize something happening at resonance? So that's an open question. And you know, what are the astrophysical estimates bounds on, let's say, the total external tidal field, on the smooth average total external tidal field? And so these are the environmental effects, and now a little bit beyond that, you know, are nasty secondaries relevant for LISA, right? So you can have a main sequence star that inspirals on something like an emery, then gets tidally disrupted, or above something which is called the Hills mass, it will not get tidally disrupted, right? And should the Capra community take a look at this? And yeah, who should care about the Kerr tidal Love number? So I'm putting it bluntly, but you know, what is the post and adiabatic order of this? What is the PN order? I need to know. So this is everything, all the questions I have for discussions. And if you want to raise your hands and say something, please. Yeah, Martin.
Just to simply answer the last question, the Kerr Love number comes in at zero post adiabatic order, but is also perfectly taken into account when doing any self-force coverage.
Okay, so it is the curl of number. Okay, but what about the secondary though?
Oh, then it's like third or fourth or fifth, very high.
Interesting. Adam?
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing as Martin about that. We're solving the Einstein equations, so we automatically get anything going on with the big black hole. Something for the small black hole we would have to put in by hand, but it's going to be very high order. What I'm wondering about all these kinds of extra effects, all these environmental effects, is have people looked at them with Fisher matrix analysis or something like that? Because as we saw with the spin, at least in some cases, you can't measure it, and it actually makes your parameter estimation, or could potentially make your parameter estimation worse for the other parameters.
So to that extent, I think I can at least for the tidal resonances one, I think the work sort of by Lorenzo that he presented today shows that you can actually measure it. Of course, he had an effective model to do this, but it was a proper data analysis paper to show that it is relevant. And the sort of jump sizes that he modeled are, you know, in this similar ballpark as the ones that we worked with. But of course, I mean, it would be good to actually properly do the analysis, and Priti is working on that.
Great. So for resonances, they're nice because it's such a distinct qualitative feature. But what about something like the effect of a disk, like tidal drag, not tidal drag, drag?
Great question. I don't know. Anyone else?
So maybe I can chime in on this. So there is this paper by Enrico Barausa, Vitor Cardoso, and others, and the title is "Can Environmental Effects Spoil the Precision Physics of Gravitational Waves?" I think. Mm-hmm. And in this paper, they basically show that the hydrodynamical drag is only relevant for highly accreting black holes. And when you have an orbit which is like all the way inside the disk, if I remember correctly. So it is a little bit of a marginal effect, but in that case, I do not believe they carried out the Fisher matrix analysis.
Yeah, I think they just showed order of magnitude that it's comparable to second order dissipative effects. But if this wet formation channel is really common, doesn't that mean we're actually going to see more of these kinds of things than we would have naively expected?
Yeah, I guess so. Jen didn't show. There is a plot showing the distribution of wet emeries versus dry emeries as a function of mass. And you can see for most of the models, it's going to be a dominant channel. So for most of the masses, And I also agree with a statement that this hydrodynamic drag is probably not very important for most of the emeries, except those with small main black hole mass. So in that case, so it's like the gravitational wave radiation reaction is more important if R is small, R of M is small. And for the same LISA frequency, for smaller smaller mass for the supermassive black hole, the R over M would be larger. So a larger radius, and then the hydrodynamical drag may be relevant. But we are talking about like 10 to the 5 solar mass black hole, something like that. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
So I don't know, Adam, if your hand means you can, you want to say anything else? I think it's up from, okay. So, I mean, but speaking of this, right? So I would say this bonus question, are nasty secondaries relevant for Lisa? That's a quite complex question because I just like noticed that from the 90s to the 2000s, people basically stopped mentioning white dwarf emeries. And I don't quite understand why. So I guess they are so light that they have a smaller SNR, but yeah, this, or they have a low formation rate, or if anyone wants to chime in.
My guess is, yeah, as you said, it's it has 10 times smaller mass than the usual star mass black hole. So you may have much less. So if you have 10 times less signal to noise ratio, then the volume is 1,000 times smaller. So.
I think Rior wanted to say something.
I was just asking if Alex is here because he had a nice paper on that not long ago, but I don't see his name and I don't remember the paper.
So the paper was with Eric Gurguion? It was.
Yes, that one.
Mm-hmm. And Niels probably can.
Oh, Niels was on it as well, yes. I think the conclusion was that we will be able to see them if they happen close enough.
Yeah, so they have to be. We were actually looking at ones around Sagittarius Star, but I think Powell put out a paper around the same time suggesting there could be quite a lot of these very light objects down there. But of course, we have no direct observation of them as yet. But on the timescale of LISA, I think telescopes are going to start observing pretty dim objects near Sagittarius, like almost to the brown dwarf level, and that might shed some light on this. But yeah, because they're so light, you're only going to see it for like Sagittarius and I guess nearby supermassive black holes.
So that's
no self-force modeling is really needed. They basically don't evolve. You could use the geodesic waveform. So we've got those modeling of those covered, I think.
So they, how close do they get to the black hole before they disappear as a signal?
You mean before they get disrupted?
Yeah.
I'd have to go back and look at the paper, but I think the brown dwarfs basically made it all the way down.
Disruption would occur for black holes that are 50,000 or 100,000 solar masses. So 10 to the 6, you're safely just perturbing it as on the inspiral.
Yeah, we looked at different objects, Jupiter-like planets and so on. Brown dwarfs, I think, are not disrupted by the time they make it. Well, I'm sure maybe high-spin curve they get disrupted. But
I mean, I think these are potentially interesting objects to look at. One additional effect besides the strength of the signal and the mass function for white dwarfs versus black holes is that there's mass segregation in the scattering, which would potentially act to kick the white dwarfs out and make them less likely to be put on capture orbits.
But for instance, for these non-compact objects, they are exactly these nasty secondaries, which have quadrupoles and hydrodynamical drag. Hydrodynamical drag for these is like 4 orders of magnitude more prominent than for compact objects. So it's, even though it can be extremely low for compact objects in a given environment and at given mass, it can be actually the dominant effect for your phase evolution for non-compact objects.
But if we are talking about our own galaxy, there's no AGM in our own galaxy, so probably not much gas around to cause hydrodynamic drag.
Yeah, I agree. So, but I mean, so for instance, one other thing which I think is worth discussing are these partial spirals, or, you know, these messy main sequence objects. So if you have a black hole of mass 10 to 7 solar masses, it will not disrupt, or, you know, up to the very end, it will not disrupt a solar type star, right? So now the question is, if we make it, for instance, you know, a red giant, which has a few hundred solar masses, and make it in spiral into a heavier black hole somewhere far out, can we still see it? Does it make sense to take a look at this?
Aren't you out of the sort of LISA sensitivity range to begin with if you have like a 10 to the 7 solar mass binary, which gets worse if you make it far away, so it also has a significant redshift?
Yeah, it's marginal. It depends how bright the signal is, of course.
Yes. Yeah, I'm pretty sure we would be able to see if this happens in Sagittarius A star.
That's right.
Oh, wait, that's not heavy enough. Isn't Andromeda the supermassive black hole about 10 to the 7?
I think it's the same as Milky Way. Who knows?
Let's ask Wikipedia.
So, I mean, maybe not all of these, you know, need to be answered right here, right now, but just like, you know, putting the question out there. Yeah, let's see.
Maybe just to say, I mean, that would be very interesting, of course, because there'd be a EM counterpart if there's something that you can see as an emery and then gets disrupted right at the end. So EM counterparts are awesome if they exist, but I have no idea what the event rates of these things would be.
According to Wikipedia, which is then obviously true, the supermassive black hole in Andromeda is about 10 to the 8th.
Yeah, then, you know, in principle, but the rates are very, very low, right? So it's, I think there is like one in a million galaxies, right, is likely to have in spirals such as these happening at any given point. So I think that's the estimate we made for our paper. So, I mean, that kind of gets me to the question, you know, so maybe kind of to ask Beatrice, or if you have done estimates like these, or maybe if you can repeat them because my brain has holes in it. So how likely is it for a third body to cause resonance, if you have anything to?
No, I have nothing profound to say there. I mean, given that we don't even know the emery rates well, I think it's really hard to say something definitive for this. I think we should really ask the astrophysicists and the people that do population dynamics these questions.
Well, this depends on how far away is the closest perturber, right? Like people have done N-body simulations. For example, I will open the heat student. I think even in Jen's focal point calculation, he can probably also do that. So you can roughly estimate what's the distance of the closest body. So
that's true. I mean, Priti did mention those numbers, but you know, we don't really know, right? We don't have data to do this. But yeah, there are numbers, and we pick reasonable numbers, but we haven't.
Of course,
done
a yeah, this calculation may assume. As a specific cluster model and this kind of thing, you may argue the real scenario could be different. Yeah, I agree with that.
So a related question to this. Is it always likely going to be that it's the closest perturber that's going to be by far the dominant effect, or is it going to be the cumulative effects of the tidal perturbations of the closest few perturbers?
Depending on how close they are. I mean, if you have two, that really depends. But it's a valid question. So I would assume that generic, these things do scale as mass over distance cubed. So if you have one nearby and the second, twice as far already, it's already, 1/8 of the strength. So it decays pretty rapidly. But if you have a bunch of them sort of in a similar orbit,
if it goes with distance cubed, the number of stars is also going to grow with distance cubed.
That's true. I know that always.
Well, it's not uniform distributed, right? So.
I guess if they're uniformly distributed, then there won't be any tidal field. So.
Yeah, I mean the density. I mean the density as a function of radius for these close perturbers. They're not constant. So.
No, but also, typically. We don't know very well the models, but they tend to be cuspy near the supermassive black hole. So,
yeah, exactly. So if you trust those simulation results, I would think the closest one or a couple would be the dominant source. Yeah, but again, if you trust those models.
But when we presented this work, which I just talked about at an astronomical conference, there were astronomers who said, well, there will be no stars as close as that because cusp is eroded due to galaxy mergers and it doesn't regrow basically ever. So say goodbye to Emery's and say goodbye to your perturbers and accretion disks, basically, which was a little bit scary. So I think there is some controversy on that and we should acknowledge it.
Yeah, so as somebody who's been listening to dynamicists, we're working on the cusp dynamics for 20 years now, I can tell you that there's absolutely no convergence and you get very wild and wide, very, very different results from these calculations. And every now and then somebody finds a new effect that changes the picture entirely. It seems to me that we won't get the answer before Lisa flies. We get the answer, listening to what Lisa tells us, I think.
Yeah, I think we'll settle on Lisa will tell.
Yes.
So maybe it's worth to mention that. The accretion disks doesn't live forever. So for most of the time, the galaxy doesn't have accretion disk, so it may turn on for a short period of time, and during that time, it will drive many star mass black holes towards the center. Some of them may merge, some of them may not have enough time and to merge, and when the disk dies, you still have leftover black holes around the supermassive black hole, and then you can compute what's the expected distance for those leftover black holes. These are usually between 100 and 200 ms. So these leftover black holes can serve as tidal perturbers as well. Although they are not formed due to scattering, they're formed due to this disk migration by previous disks. So that could be another origin for these tidal perturbers.
So this is a very interesting discussion so far. I'm just thinking whether we should discuss any of the other topics about, tidal love numbers and so on. So if there were any questions or things that were unclear during the talks. So if anyone wants to raise a point here, maybe.
Well, maybe I can ask the question again that I asked during talk. So I would imagine for this resonance, if I know the initial orbital phase, I can compute everything. I don't need to assign arbitrary phase for the resonance, especially if I have multiple resonances. It's like I need to make several new parameters in my waveform, and that's going to be expensive. I don't know if people can comment on that and how are we able to determine that phase when we enter the resonance?
I think the answer is no. It's you won't be able to. You'll have to put one parameter for each new resonance, I think, starting from the second.
I mean, Neil, do you mean like no for right now or no forever?
I think between now and Lisa, because even if you know how to model a single resonance, you won't get the phase at the end at the required order. This sort of jumps one post adiabatic order every time, right?
It's half an order, so you lose half an order of information through every resonance.
Yeah. So it's kind of hopeless.
So unless we're doing second.
It's capped at 0.5 post adiabatic order.
What's that?
It's never going to be more than 0.5 post adiabatic order. The accumulated phase error.
Yeah, but what Leo and I were saying is that the information comes from one order higher each time, or half an order higher each time.
Yeah.
If I can ask a question about that, it seems to me that if assume the simplest case where we have an entire in spiral with multiple resonance crossings, we need a self-consistent evolution across all of those resonances. So if we observe the end, in some sense, we should be able to work back and say, well, what did the phase have to be when we entered the nth resonance? And then go back to say, what was it when we exited n minus one and work backwards? Is this possible? Can we actually piece together a complete self-consistent thing without having these completely arbitrary parameters, but rather saying, okay, here's what the phases had to be at each resonance entry in order to be consistent with the following non-resonant section of the trajectory?
So is that not kind of equivalent to putting in just extra fitting parameters, and you just do an inverse problem to extract, basically make the initial phase one of your fitting parameters?
Perhaps, but my point is that these fitting parameters aren't arbitrary at the end of the day. That is, these aren't free parameters at the end of the day. Rather, these are forced. These have to be consistent with the Einstein equations and with our hopefully to be calculated second order in spiral trajectories.
The trouble is, if you have two resonances, they better be consistent with the third order in spiral trajectories.
Then the point is that
you've got to go to fourth order.
Oh, I see what you mean. I see your point.
Yeah, we don't have the theory to model those the accuracy at the exit very accurately. And
so what you're saying is that by the time you've done a few of them, there's no way you could model the first resonance crossing accurately enough to reliably trust certainly the first resonance translates into order ends by the time you got to the second or third resonance. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Exactly. In other words, if all you have is a second order perturbation theory, given the initial phase, you don't know what the phase will be after three resonances. You need more than second order perturbation theory.
So perhaps I can add something to this in a moment, but Georgios has his hand up for some time, so maybe.
Yeah, just a question. Does it matter, really? Cannot the detection will be made, or will we have the data? So cannot we just go through it several times until we fit it? So if you have the adiabatic spiral and then just try to fill the rest, we'll have plenty of years of, or this is a no-go because we have to disentangle it from the other signals which we'll be receiving simultaneously.
So that relates to what Leo put in the chart. It's probably not an issue for detection, not least because you don't have many strong resonances in one inspire, I think. You'll have one or two at most, but not more than that. And the others will be weak. So it's probably not an issue for detection. But you may get biases in the parameter estimation from these things. And yeah. So you won't be able to detect, to tell the other parameters as accurately as you would if you had a good model of
yeah, the phase. This is my point. So we can make the detection and make the extract the information later on without being pushed to hurry. And I don't know. My point is that, okay, you have the tidal resonances, you have transient resonances from surfaces, you have the okay, probably not, but sustained resonances. We have different sources. Spin will induce resonances. So what we call prolonged ones with the breaking of integrability. And this is also a point that I would like to ask. It's connected with what Leo asked previously. I don't understand why the prolonged one are not the same one with tidal resonances, but this is another question. But you have plenty of sources, so probably we can just gather the data and go through it for several years until we find the proper model to fit them.
So maybe if no one has their hand up at this point, yeah, that's my question about like it's. Yeah, there are many sources of resonances. So, but I mean, about the remarks of losing phase accuracy. So in the scheme, which we actually published this year with Georgios, you can switch between various kind of, you know, an adiabatic or post-1 adiabatic treatment and then a near resonant treatment. You have to choose the switching criteria and so on, you know, has to still be worked out in detail. But you know, the asymptotic analysis tells you that if you do everything right, your global phase error at the end of the inspiral after the crossing of one resonance should be square root of epsilon. So you are not completely spoiling the one adiabatic expansion after one resonance. And the second resonance, I guess, would make an O1 error in the end, which is still not as terrible, I think.
Yeah, so I think that's an agreement with the discussion in Hinder and Flanagan. And is it an order one phase error not pretty bad?
Well, I mean, given that you have already fitted to resonances, I think, you know, you should pat yourself on the back. You do that.
Okay, I can be happy with that.
I mean, yeah, I would say also, at least kind of like the preliminary tests that have been done, the actual dephasing that these resonance seems to cause tends to be a couple radians, even though it's supposed to scale like 1 over the mass ratio to the 1/2. So that coefficient out in front might be favorably small, which might make these effects not as pronounced as we're all worried about. But, you know, that's something we can only know by kind of doing full in spirals.
So that's actually something I wanted to ask Zach. So, I mean, did I understand your talk correctly that in principle, your data is, you know, could be understood as consistent with the integrability conjecture, or did I misunderstand? You know, with a numerical error?
I would say with the new regularization data we receive from Anna that it is not consistent with the integrability conjecture. It does seem that you get conservative contributions that, you know, have some secular accumulation during the resonance. So I think that just means that you need to make sure that you're including secular perturbations when you do these types of like transformations where you try to remove certain oscillatory pieces. You just need to keep the conservative component. But I don't think that it might be a kind of pain because we try to calculate the conservative piece as little as possible, but we'll have to calculate the first order gravitational self-force in full no matter what, so.
Interesting.
So I just wanted to follow up with something that someone mentioned that confused me. If you have multiple resonances, things scale differently. We need higher order self force corrections. Can someone explain that again?
So it is just that you need to have the phase when entering the resonance very accurately. And you are unable to treat the phase to sufficient accuracy when you pass at first through the resonance. So you carry that error with you to the second entrance into the resonance.
Okay. So,
and then you know that shows up in the final phase. So Leo, you wanted to say something?
Actually, yeah, could I just get clarification from Beatrice and Martin on why you need very special conditions for tides to generate sustained resonances?
I'll let Martin answer that because the question is essentially the same for self-force resonances as for tidal resonances.
Yeah, so it isn't hard necessarily to generate a tidal field that allows for sustained resonances. You just need a tidal perturber to be close enough and have big enough mass in order for that to work. And at some point I did look at it, it's not impossible to get the mass and distance to work. You probably need to introduce an intermediate mass black hole at not too big distance to get it to work, but it's not excluded. The problem is that it's still going to be a relatively small tidal field. And if you work through the evolution equations for the resonance, in most cases, sort of at leading order in that perturbation, you can't get captured in the sustained resonance.
Sorry, did you say
can? The equation of motion for the resonant phase is a part of the one for one-dimensional particle moving in some static potential. There are state resonances in the potential has local minima. So at leading order, you can't ever get stuck in the local minima because you started outside of a local of them. So the only way to get stuck in them is to look at the next order term in the perturbation. And because it's the next order term in the perturbation, it's going to be small, essentially.
I mean, I guess I don't really understand what this effective potential is that you're talking about. I just thought, you know, if I'm looking at Poincaré sections of motion around, if I make Poincaré sections of the orbital dynamics, and then I add a external tidal potential on top, the resonant tori break up and you get little Poincaré-Birkhoff chains, right? And every one of those islands is potentially a sustained resonance, because if your trajectory through the phase plane goes through one of those islands, inside of that island everywhere, the frequency ratio is, you know, that's a plateau, isn't it?
Yeah, but once you add dissipation to the problem, it's going to wash out most of those islands, essentially. And
So this is a confusion. One thing is prolonged resonances, another thing is sustained resonances. At least we have to somehow clarify the terminology. Prolonged resonances is what Leo describes. Breaking of the phase space, creation of Birkhoff islands of stability and crossing these islands. This can be transient, that means that it's of the order of a portion, let's say 1% of the total inspire, and then you have sustained what is described like, okay, you get in, you don't get out, or you started in and you remain inside. So you can have prolonged resonances that are transient and sustained. And I agree with Martin that the sustained, I think, is probably improbable situation, but I think what Leo is saying correctly, if you have a perturber, is a three-body system, basically. You bring a two-body system, a third body. From classical mechanics, you know that it's chaotic, and so it should have what Leo describes, breaking of tori, the resonant tori, creation of Birkhoff islands, etc. So these are two different things. So we don't expect sustained ones, but we expect the prolonged ones from here.
Yes, but the prolonged ones aren't going to act any differently to a normal transient resonance. Other than that, you can the kick as a perturbative expansion.
We don't know if there will be a kick or what.
Okay, but it's like a very smoking gun. Like, it's very easy to see in the data if you have this prolonged resonance, right?
Yeah, it should. It should be in the conservative with sub-dissipation. If you plot it, you should see it.
Do you have I have not been looking at the right literature, I guess. Do you have a reference that clarifies the distinction between sustained and prolonged resonances?
I think we have to clarify it as a community. We tried with Wojciech in the recent contribution to the handbook. The sustained ones are the ones that, if the definition is that they remain in the resonance, is sustained. Prolonged ones, we call the ones that are caused by the breaking of integrability. Basically, when you have to cross a Birkhoff island of stability, this chain of islands.
So Adam wanted to say something as well.
Yeah, so I just had a question about that chapter that you guys wrote. So I almost never read literature, but I did read that. And it was quite nice, but I didn't come away actually understanding how we're supposed to treat the prolonged resonances, because it seemed like one section was saying, basically just do what Hinder and Flanagan were suggesting. And then I wasn't clear if that was what the takeaway, or if we need to do something different.
Okay, Wojciech. I think with Wojciech we have quite different views or approach to this thing. So when we wrote this, I think we wanted to present both of them. I think Wojciech believes that we can treat them purely analytically and provide some, I don't know if I can say it correctly, semi-analytical or handling of the case, which is possible, I don't know. But since we are in a chaotic system, I think we will have quite big dependence on the phase that we enter the resonance. I think this is okay with some averaging, maybe, I don't know, but my side is more that we should look at it as a dynamical feature that changes all the time. But I think what Wojciech suggested is very useful. If we can do it, I think it will be a very useful tool to handle this whole thing instead of just saying, okay, it's chaos, so we depend on the phase. So yes, there are two different, views how to handle the topic in this chapter.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I'm not sure if we can continue with this discussion because I think our time is roughly up for this topic.